Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
This is Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, coming to you on the eve of International Women's Day 2022, a celebration which has unfortunately been overshadowed by world events. I had planned on bringing Jensen Williams of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis on the show again to talk about the history of this day and its ongoing importance here in the 21st century. But she, understandably, has her hands full preparing for the International Women's Day rally that will be taking place at noon on March 8th in front of Guelph City Hall, an event which you should all try to attend if you are able, those of you who are in the local Guelph area. And she'll most likely be joining me again later in the month or early April to talk more about the women's struggle around the world and in Canada and around the world. So please stay tuned for that. But while I would prefer to spend this episode focusing on the heroic women who stood up in Petrograd on March 8th, 1917, playing a key role in overthrowing a czar, ending a war, and changing world history, the current reality demands that I address the situation in Ukraine. And this is itself noteworthy. I mean, the Western media never provided nonstop coverage of the now 7-year-long war in Yemen, which is also the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world right now. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have died. The NCRA never sent out recommendations to campus community radio stations across Canada telling them to beware of Israeli misinformation during that country's multiple assaults on Gaza. You know, going back to 2008 and 2009, you know, and happening pretty much yearly ever since. Neither Iraq, nor Libya, nor Syria, nor Afghanistan were given this kind of coverage. And people were not forced to choose sides in these wars by the powers that be. The last time I remember anything like that happening was after 9/11, back in 2001. The Russian incursion into Ukraine is being treated as an attack against us all, in the same way as when those planes hit the Twin Towers in New York City. And it's worth asking why that is. You know, we're all being encouraged to jump into this conflict, to be invested in this conflict, to identify with the Ukrainian people who are on the receiving end of, you know, this Russian invasion. And it is worth asking why that is. You know, why this war? Why not all these other wars that have been going on in the global south? You know, in West Asia, in Africa, in South America, all these places, why are they not given this kind of attention? And, well, I mean, the answer is actually pretty obvious. I mean, numerous Western news outlets from CBS to the BBC have openly stated in their coverage of the Ukraine conflict that the reason why the war in Ukraine is so terrible is because it is in, quote-unquote, a civilized European country populated by white people who, quote, look like you and me. They've openly said this on numerous instances that have been kind of chronicled. I mean, you can find these on social media. And just how blatant this is, right? Just how blatant their this talking point is. And just this idea that we must stand in racial solidarity with a white country under attack is, this is the dominant subtext in the media coverage of this war. And the same reporters repeat that Ukraine is not Afghanistan or Iraq, where violence has effectively been normalized in public discourse over the years, and that we should be shocked by a war on European soil, even though we're talking about a continent marked by the bloodiest conflicts in human history. You know, namely, you know, World War I and II. Like, apparently, what, we've forgotten that? You know, and we see the same racialized, you know, just how racialized this discourse is. In terms of how the mainstream media effectively blocked for quite a while, you know, for over a week, and only belatedly started to cover the horrific racist treatment of refugees, of black and brown refugees fleeing Ukraine and trying to get into Poland, trying to get into the EU, trying to get into Western countries, and how these people, mainly international students from India and numerous African countries, have been forcibly prevented from boarding trains and buses out of the country, and they face violence from Ukrainian security forces and armed Ukrainian civilians, and also like by Polish security forces as well at the border. They finally had to cover that because there was such a backlash on social media, you know, just calling them out, calling out the mainstream media, calling out CBS and the BBC, telling them that they need to focus on this stuff. And, you know, but that was really not the priority. They were focusing on white people fleeing from Ukraine, white Ukrainians fleeing from Ukraine and streaming into places like Poland and where, of course, they've been given complete access, no obstructions, no racist attacks, you know, nothing. They're just kind of welcomed in as family. Meanwhile, of course, we've been seeing for years how Syrian refugees have been treated, refugees from Africa, how they've been treated, from Afghanistan, you name it. I mean, just last year we had like, I think it was about like almost 3,000 Afghan Syrian refugees being stuck at the border of Belarus, on the Polish border with Belarus and Poland, being denied entry at the point of a gun, you know, being forcibly prevented from entering Poland and being effectively stranded on the border for, you know, for months and months, and many of them dying of hypothermia even as the temperatures dropped and the winter set in. But, you know, that's not what we're seeing with the current influx of Ukrainian refugees who are white. You know, and they're getting wall-to-wall coverage and stuff. And, like, you know, these black and brown people who were on the receiving end of this violence were effectively ignored. So we see the racialized, like, coverage of the war and just how, what victims of war are given attention, are considered worthy of attention. But the main thing I want to stress here is that this war is not new. It did not begin with Russia's intervention on the 26th of February. In fact, it's been raging since 2014, when the democratically elected government of Ukraine was overthrown in a violent US-backed coup. And this coup, often referred to as Euromaidan, featured a heavy presence of far-right neo-Nazi elements acting as shock troops against the government security forces in the street battles that erupted in Kiev and other cities. And these far-right forces then gained prominent positions in the post-coup government that was fully backed by the United States and NATO, which proceeded to destroy or drive underground essentially every progressive political force in the country, from trade unions to the Communist Party. And the 2014 Odessa massacre, in which dozens of people were shot or burned to death by neo-Nazi militia at the trade union headquarters in the city of Odessa, was among the ugliest of these incidents in this campaign of terror, which also involved banning the Russian language in schools and businesses and essentially giving away the entire Ukrainian economy to the IMF and Western business interests, just destroying all protections for workers. And it was this violent seizure of power by the far right, you know, and by, like, fanatical neoliberal interests who, of course, like, privatized the entire economy. This is what led to the civil war in eastern Ukraine, which continues to this day. And Ukrainian leftists and Russian-speaking sectors of the population, in 2014, they armed themselves in defiance of the coup government and its fascist thugs. They defended themselves. And while they received some aid from Russia, they were mainly on their own in the harrowing battles of 2014 and 2015, when the self-proclaimed People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk were besieged again and again by the Ukrainian army. And the signing of the Minsk Accords in 2015 was meant to end this conflict by granting autonomy to these breakaway republics within Ukraine, you know, granting them, like, basically federal status within Ukraine and guaranteeing new elections. But these peace accords were never actually implemented by the Ukrainian government, which went on shelling and attacking Donetsk and Luhansk right up to the current escalation of the war in 2022, right? 15,000 people have died in eastern Ukraine since 2014. Yet this goes unrecognized in Western media portrayals of the conflict, as does the powerful influence of neo-Nazi and far-right political forces, which has been continually downplayed. And, I mean, for those who believe that the far-right in Ukraine is somehow fringe, they were strong enough to openly defy, you know, these neo-Nazis were strong enough to openly defy the Ukrainian president himself, Zelensky, in 2019, when he belatedly tried to implement the provisions of the Minsk Accord. These far-right groups were strong enough to force him to back down and go on with the aggression against the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics and continue with the shelling and the violence. I mean, the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion and similar military formations are now fully integrated into the Ukrainian army, the National Guard, and police. They are not fringe elements. And their bloody reign of terror against leftists and ethnic minorities in Ukraine has continued. I've talked on this show before about how Canada, the US, and Israel have armed and trained these fascist goon squads And to some extent, the Western press is actually praising them in the present conflict for being the fiercest fighters defending Ukraine against Russia. But the pivotal U.S. role in the conflict must be understood, because fundamentally, it never would have even begun without the U.S.-supported coup in 2014 and NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe after the Cold War. You know, NATO has been pushing right up to Russia's borders, you know, in the Baltic states, in Poland, you know, all these places. And Ukraine, like, I mean, that's just, you know, a complete assault on Russia's near abroad, basically. You know, like, you're bringing, like, you know, if NATO succeeds in bringing Ukraine into the fold, I mean, that basically brings NATO soldiers right up to Russia's borders. And Russia has made that very clear that that is a red line for them. They will not allow that. And yet, you know, the U.S. continues to push and push and push and push, you know, ignoring those security concerns. I mean, the war in Ukraine is the most manufactured conflict I've seen since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The U.S. engineered the violence in 2014. They engineered it in order to secure its own strategic interests in Eastern Europe. And it has never allowed for any peaceful settlement or meaningful de-escalation since then. You know, and for the past 2 months, we've seen the United States government deliberately escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine, preparing people for war via the most insane media blitz I've ever seen. You know, constantly saying that Russia's going to invade, Russia's going to invade, Russia's going to invade. You got to be prepared for war. You know, we got to, you know, and all this while rejecting Russian diplomatic overtures and, you know, attempts to de-escalate the situation and sabotaging every attempt in recent years at dialogue and de-escalation between Russia and Ukraine. I mean, it was largely through U.S. efforts that the Minsk Accords were never implemented by the Ukrainian government. And of course, now that the conflict has escalated, with the Russian intervention, it is now dumping, the U.S. is now dumping more guns and military hardware in Ukraine instead of facilitating peace talks, which is the same thing it did in Syria. If you recall, in Syria, I mean, more than $1 billion worth of American military hardware was shipped into the country during the war there, which, needless to say, did nothing to de-escalate that conflict. I mean, this is not a inter-imperialist conflict between rival empires. You know, we're not seeing, like, the American Empire on one side and the Russian Empire on the other side, and they're butting heads, you know, with Ukraine caught in the middle. This is actually an example of a global superpower. Remember, like, you know, the United States continues to be the sole superpower in the world in the wake of the Cold War. This is an example of a global superpower manipulating two neighboring countries into fighting one another by rendering peace impossible. I mean, effectively what you're seeing is the U.S. using the Ukrainian people, and they've been doing this for years, they've been doing this since 2014, using the Ukrainian people as cannon fodder in its conflict with Russia. You know, it's absolutely sickening. We're seeing the Ukrainian people being used, you know, being thrown in a meat grinder, so to speak, by Western interests, which have been deliberately stoking tensions, provoking conflict in the region for years now, you know, deliberately undermining all attempts at de-escalation, all attempts at peace, and they continue to do so. You know, they've had, there have been peace talks since the beginning of this conflict. There have been about two rounds have already happened. Probably a third round is going to happen very soon. But each time, you know, there is no settlement. And of course, one of the reasons for that is because, well, the U.S. keeps giving the guns. They keep bringing in guns. They keep bringing in hardware, promising aid, all this kind of stuff. Even as they, you know, they're not going to send in troops. They're not going to get directly involved. They're not going to impose no-fly zones or do anything like this. They're not going to do anything like that, because that, of course, would lead to World War III, and they know that. But they're going to keep egging on the Ukrainians, encouraging the Ukrainians to be tough against Russia, not to compromise. And of course, what's that going to lead to? That's just going to lead to more dead Ukrainians. and the United States frankly does not care. Just like it did not care about the Afghan people in the 1980s when they were arming and training the Mujahideen against the Soviets and doing nothing to de-escalate that conflict, instead pouring gasoline on it. And of course, Afghanistan has never recovered from that level of violence, that level of destruction in which, like, you know, hundreds of thousands, even millions of Afghans died. And in fact, then, of course, the U.S. invades again in 2001 and, you know, occupies the country for more than two decades. You know, leaving in an absolute devastated state. You know, this is what the U.S. does. This is what imperialism does. It uses people. It uses entire countries. It devastates whole countries in order to get what it wants. And that's what the U.S. has been doing in Ukraine. The context is absolutely crucial to understand. And really, these clips I want to play tonight, because I don't want to editorialize for the entire show here. The clips I'm going to play here really illustrate the context very effectively for those, particularly on the left, who want to make a contribution to peace, I would say. Because, like, really what we need to be doing right now is pushing for peaceful de-escalation of the conflict. You know, no more deaths, no more violence, no more lives lost. And we want to see a peaceful settlement that ensures justice for all. That's really what we want. So I want to switch to a very fine interview discussion from Breakthrough News about how the anti-war movement should approach the war in Ukraine. And I'll follow that up with an excellent talk by Danny Haifong, a comrade from New York City, and his analysis of America's involvement in the Ukraine conflict. And Danny Haifong is with the Left Lens. I would encourage you all to check that out. And with Black Agenda Report, which is an amazing, independent news source as well. So I'm going to turn it over to the clip from Breakthrough News right here. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I want to talk about building an anti-war movement in the United States with those who are doing that very thing. Very happy to be joined by Walter Smolarek, who's a national organizer with the Answer Coalition, and good friend of the show, Kim Smith, who's an anti-racism and anti-war organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation based in South Carolina. Walter, Kim, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kim, let me start with you. I mentioned that you're in South Carolina, not just because I love South Carolina, but specifically because your senior senator, Lindsey Graham, is like one of the most warlike individuals in Congress on this and other issues. And, you know, I just wonder, I know you all are working there in South Carolina to build resistance to escalation by the United States. How are you talking to people about this conflict, why it matters, why they should do something in a context where I'm sure a lot of the leaders in your state are, you know, really going overboard in promoting an aggressive U.S. policy?
Yeah, I had to stop myself. I promised myself I wouldn't roll my eyes too hard when you mentioned Lindsey Graham's name, but I failed. I think it's really important to, honestly, when we talk about war in general, war impacts everybody. Rania, you talked about earlier how it impacts Lebanon and how these sanctions impact Lebanon. And like just bringing it back to just good old South Carolina, like, we have one of the largest training bases in the country at Fort Jackson. You know, we train the most soldiers, and so much funding goes into our military apparatus here that's being taken out of our communities. And I think talking to working class people, and when we talk to people about that, I think the biggest thing is to tell them, like, yo, this money should be going into our communities. This money should be going into education. We should not, and I talk about this with you, Eugene, all the time, we should not have a quarter of shame in South Carolina where people don't have educational standards at all. We shouldn't have areas that don't have running water. But Lindsey Graham wants to continue this propaganda and put in warmongering and doesn't want to meet the people's needs here. And like the people are going to suffer. And I think starting with that, when we're doing, you know, trying to build an anti-war movement or build up the anti-war movement, because it's always been an anti-war movement. But like as we build it up, just letting people know, like, yo, this is coming out of our communities. This is coming out of things that the people need, our basic needs. And I think that's just a great starting point.
You know, Walter, let me ask you this sort of related question, because I think, you know, when we're talking about this issue, you know, what people I think are saying is, you know, do you oppose what Russia did? Do you support what Russia did? And that's the whole sort of substance of the conversation about what should be done. And I think subsidiarily, it's sort of like, you know, if you don't aggressively go out and say you oppose it and foreground that, that somehow you're acting in a traitorous way. So I wonder just how you're responding to that question when you were out with the Answer Coalition, also working to try to raise awareness about how we got here and, you know, how a lot of the solutions to resolving this mean no escalation from the United States.
Yeah, well, I think it's a huge, absolutely essential task of the anti-war movement to explain to people that this conflict didn't just begin a couple of weeks ago or a couple months ago. I mean, in a way, this has really been building for like 25 years. When NATO began its eastward expansion following the collapse of the Soviet Union, absorbing more and more formerly socialist countries in Eastern Europe, including some former republics of the Soviet Union, like Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. That's really where this conflict began, and it's the consequence of decades of NATO aggression finally boiling over. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to defend the decision of the Russian government to invade Ukraine, certainly not. But it's so essential to get this context out there because the US corporate media is just a nonstop propaganda machine for the Pentagon and for the State Department. And so I think that's really our task here to explain that. So there's the issue of NATO expansion in general. And then there's what happened in Ukraine specifically. In February 2014, there was a coup in Ukraine. The elected government, corrupt but elected government of Yanukovych, was overthrown in a U.S.-backed color revolution. It involved neo-Nazi elements as essentially the sort of fighting vanguard of that coup. And that is what began the civil war inside of Ukraine. I mean, people in the east of the country initiated an armed struggle in the wake of that takeover. That's how you get the creation of the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics. So this was a long time coming. And this war would not have happened if NATO and particularly the United States agreed to cease its expansion and provide basic security guarantees to Russia, for instance, pledging to not station advanced missiles inside of Ukraine. And we should also note that the United States in recent years withdrew from two crucial arms control treaties, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and the Open Skies Treaty. That also sent an unmistakable aggressive signal to Russia. I mean, all of these facts are so, so important, I think. Getting them out there as aggressively as we possibly can is really the central task at this moment of the U.S. anti-war movement.
I'm curious, the biggest challenges with this particular current crisis, and how does it compare to trying to organize against past wars? I imagine one of the challenges is that the role of the U.S. is much more hidden. The role of NATO is hidden. As far as the media landscape, it looks like, you know, if you're watching CNN or reading the New York Times, it's all Russia invaded Ukraine. It stops there. And so I imagine when you're talking to people and you're trying to organize against escalation, I imagine that's probably one of the challenges. No?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of the challenge here. I mean, it's different than, say, in Libya, where it was the United States going in and dropping the bombs. To explain this requires, I think, a lot more historical context. But there are certain basic things that I think remain the same. I mean, the point that you all were making before, that, you know, this is a war for the profiteers, for the military corporations. You know, all of those things remain fundamentally the same. But yeah, I mean, this explanation, I think, requires a lot of persistence and patience with people. You know, I think it'll become clear, though, how reactionary, anti-worker, and just generally, you know, militaristic this whole war drive is. You know, it's not simply about coming to the aid of the embattled Ukrainian people trying to defend their democracy. It'll become clear, I think, as this goes on, that this is part of a grand strategy, a much broader strategy by the United States to militarize Eastern Europe, to increase their troop presence there, to station advanced weapons inside of Europe, and to generally try to dominate the region and to dominate the globe. So I think we need to stand strong in these sort of initial, more difficult days and keep building that movement over the long term.
You know, Kim, one question I have for you that when we're talking about war, we're always talking about propaganda. We're talking about framing, you know, the enemy politics. And I wonder, someone like yourself who has done so much organizing around mass incarceration, around racist policing, how it hits you to hear sort of it's like a democracy versus authoritarianism. And, you know, America's good because we're a democracy. Russia's bad because they're totalitarian. Maybe I'll just stop there, but I mean, how does that strike you as someone who's done so much around the police state?
I think I just have to, you know, sometimes you gotta laugh to stop from crying, because it's just like, yo, we want to talk about a dictatorship. We want to talk about, like, first of all, you know, good old South Carolina, you know, my grandparents are survivors of Jim Crow fascism. You know, my great grandparents lived through that, you know, rest in peace. So, first of all, if we want to talk about a dictatorship and we want to talk about authoritarianism, we need to look at, the U.S. need to put the mirror on themselves, right? You know, during the 2020 George Floyd uprising, I saw tanks, you know, I saw militarized police on protesters who were doing nothing but protesting for human rights, protesting for basic human rights, not to get shot by cops. And they were sending out gas cans and tanks and tear gassing people. And they were using the same tear gas canisters that Israel uses on Palestinians. So we want to talk about it. Let's talk about it. And when we talk about, when they want to talk about Russia's this and Russia's that, you know, coming into International Working Women's Month, the Democrats didn't even pass the Women Health Protection Act. It didn't have enough votes. So we're still fighting for bodily autonomy over here. We're still fighting for basic health care because abortions are health care. We're still fighting for people not to be incarcerated. You know, the U.S. incarcerates children. Our juvenile justice system is ballooning with kids. Little kids are in cages. You know, we see our elders are locked up. They can't even get out. You know, our elders are dying from COVID inside prisons. You know, we have people who are going against psychological warfare and torture being in solitary. So I just think it's just ridiculous that the U.S. can paint Russia as this, oh, the big bad Russians, which is just totally anti-communist propaganda, and not even take a second to look at what U.S. does to Black people in this country and poor people in this country and just the horrible conditions that people live in that there is no excuse for.
I think that's a very good point, and I think we also saw this in terms of the criminal charges that they were giving people there during the uprising, right, Kim?
Yeah, exactly. You know, being a part of the Soda City Bail Fund, people were getting hit with felony charges. For, you know, we had people who were just out giving water to protesters and would get arrested and get a felony charge. Like, people's lives were ruined for protesting. Like, people, you know, this showed up on someone's record that they had a felony for disturbing the peace and, you know, assault to a police officer. And that person was literally just giving out water to protesters.
Wow.
That's it.
You know,
and his life is ruined.
It is interesting how, and I'm not saying this is the reason why the U.S. is escalating. Obviously, it's a benefit, but it is amazing how overnight all of the issues that you just brought up, whether we're talking about racist policing or mass incarceration, or the fact that like a million people have died preventable deaths from COVID, which the U.S. completely failed at containing. The fact that Joe Biden has completely failed to pass any of the so supposedly progressive ideas and policies that he campaigned on implementing. The fact that like our government has been a complete failure as more Americans fall into poverty because they couldn't renew the child tax credit. Like all of these things were piling up. This administration was completely unpopular. And now overnight, the conversation has changed. And it is incredible how beneficial war is on so many levels, because then everything else takes a back seat, including all of the issues that you're talking about. It just gets papered over the fact that there's people still facing criminal charges from protesting, which we're supposed to celebrate when Russians do it. But in the U.S., it's like a bad thing. That's more of a comment than a question. But I'm just curious, like, does when this kind of war situation, this climate of a rush to war takes over, does it impact the ability to organize around these other issues?
I think in some ways it does. I think it does sometimes impact the way we can organize around these other issues because people are so brought in by that U.S. propaganda sometimes that they forget about the war taking place at home. And they're so focused and like get caught up in this like media campaign that the U.S. has going because, you know, the media, not y'all, you know, we love y'all, shout out BT News, but like the usual capitalist media literally puts out all of this propaganda just to get American people to focus on it and forget about these other issues sometimes. But luckily, we're in such a great, I feel like, phase in the movement and the struggle that people aren't forgetting about it. People aren't like, you know, I was so happy when, you know, Biden had his State of the Union, not that I wanted to hear him talk, but the response and people were calling out those contradictions and calling out, yo, you didn't talk about student loans. Yo, what do you mean we're past COVID? People are dying still. And it was just such a good space. It was a good place to be in. And it shows how forward this movement is going.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kim, I know you have a lot going on, so we're going to let you go here and not take more of your time, but I just wanted to really appreciate you. That's Kim Smith, longtime strong organizer on almost all the important issues to working class people in South Carolina with the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
So first, I want to talk about my initial reaction to Joe Biden's State of the Union address. I was only able to watch in full, and then I watched clips and did some reading about the second half, but I was really only able to watch the first third to a half of it live. And my reaction to the first 15 minutes was one of just utter contempt. Joe Biden, of course, was not elected on a peace agenda. He was not elected on a peace platform. Joe Biden has been a hawk toward Russia for much of his career. He's been a neocon hawk for all of his career. And it was inevitable that U.S. imperialism would escalate under his rule. There was not going to be any rollback from the Trump era, that there would just be a shift in how imperialism wages war abroad. And that is exactly what Joe Biden essentially articulated to Americans and all people who are viewing his State of the Union address. It was actually quite frightening, and people should have been scared listening to the address because of the way that he was bragging for 15 straight minutes about how much he was going to essentially provoke and contain Russia through direct military support of Ukraine and through the starvation sanctions that Joe Biden is going to continue to place onto Russia. And he announced that he was going to have all flights to and from Russia, American flights, American Airlines, not the company American Airlines, but U.S. Airlines, they were going to cancel all flights to and from Russia, which is a very big economic move, a part of the sanctions regime. But to hear him brag and then to hear the chants of USA, USA, USA from Congress definitely gave me fascist vibes. I mean, this is something that needs to be discussed in this way. The way that Joe Biden so brazenly bragged about how tough he was going to be on Russia should be a pause for concern. And it just shows that this new Cold War is not going anywhere, no matter what happens in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. And an update on that, right? If you've been following people like Pepe Escobar and other geopolitical analysts who are following the situation closely on the ground, it is quite clear that all of this bluster about, and we saw it during the speech, this bluster about Ukraine in this heroic fight back against Russia is essentially just lies, right? Russia has a particular military strategy that is not being wrestled with or talked about, because that would mean the U.S. would have to acknowledge that the adversary, quote unquote, this adversary, Russia, is actually strategically going about this conflict with Ukraine in a way that will eventually see results. And I do believe that it will eventually see results unless the United States decides and NATO decides to ramp up the escalations beyond just indirect military assistance and direct economic sanctions, right? I think that Russia has surrounded, it seems pretty clear that Russia has surrounded Ukraine, and now it is going to place as much pressure on the Ukrainian government, on Ukraine's government as possible, to force it to negotiate. And say what you will about that strategy, because there will obviously be costs, and those costs are human costs, and I do not support those human costs. That is an unfortunate byproduct of war and the situation that came about based upon the developments that have occurred between Ukraine and Russia over the last 8 years alone, but even further back. But nonetheless, that is the strategy, and this is war, and this is the reality of war. So back to the State of the Union address, because this is what Joe Biden was addressing, right? And he goes over and over and over and on and on and on about how the United States stands up for freedom over tyranny. It was American exceptionalism on steroids. He talked about the Ukraine coup in such an ahistorical manner, a complete lie. He talked about how 6 years ago, Putin rolled into Ukraine thinking he could take it. Well, he rolled in, I think he used the term, a wall of strength of the Ukrainian people. That whole description is just inverse, a complete inverse of the reality. Russia didn't roll into Ukraine in 2014. There was a coup that took place, a coup d'etat that took place against a democratically elected government that was simply considering a more balanced approach between the EU and Russia, Viktor Yanukovych's administration. And that is what sparked the unrest from pro-EU. And then we saw fascistic forces openly opposing Yanukovych and going for the gusto, going for it all, seeking the overthrow of the government. And that is what occurred. There was no rolling in. There was a response by Russia, which was to hold a referendum for Crimea, which is what Crimea wanted, in order to admit Crimea into the Russian Federation and provide protection from and protection of Russia's naval bases in Crimea, but protection also of the people of Crimea from what exactly has happened since the coup in 2014, which was the civil war that was sparked, this far-right attack on Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine in the Donbass region, which has killed more than 14,000 people, most of them civilians from this region. That is what happened, right? And then the coup government took on a semi, if not fully, fascistic form all the way into the elections of 2019, which elected a closet puppet of the United States and NATO, as we're seeing now, but someone who was supposed to reform all the corruption that came after Maidan. In any event, right, that's how Joe Biden talked about this. It was the United States standing for freedom, standing for these heroic Ukrainian people who are pushing back Russia. You saw the celebration of the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States who was in attendance, and there was the standing ovation. And then you see Jill Biden, Joe Biden's wife, hugging her, and all of this very staged emotion in order to bring about a shift in public opinion, this continued shift of public opinion toward support for all of these policies, the sanctions and the increased military aggression and aid to Ukraine. So Biden talked about Russia's intervention as premeditated and unprovoked. He said this, premeditated, unprovoked. And this has been the narrative of the US media, the Western media, right? Russia is just in it to destroy the lives of Ukrainian people. It's trying to stomp on democracy. It is essentially just waging war for war's sake, for expansionism, for the return of the Russian Empire. In this simplistic narrative and borderline racist narrative, right, because it's all about this Eastern kind of barbaric attempt to suppress and overthrow the benevolent West and the whiteness that it represents and all of the goodness that it represents, this simplistic explanation completely falsifies the facts of the situation. He says, Joe Biden, that Russia rejected efforts at diplomacy. I seem to remember Joe Biden not too many months ago meeting with Vladimir Putin, talking to him and saying, no, we're not going to listen to you at all. We're going to continue to militarize Ukraine, give them weapons, and we're going to continue to say that Ukraine can choose to come into NATO if it wants to, and wink, 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 you want to, right? We're going to continue to interfere in Ukraine's affairs. We don't care what you say. And I think I remember Russia not too long ago, less than, you know, within the last month, giving specific proposals and requests, both to the United States, to NATO, saying, this is what we want. We want to negotiate over the demilitarization of Ukraine and the potential admission of Ukraine into NATO. We see those as red lines, right? We need those to be respected. We need Ukraine to be neutral and not be in NATO. It cannot be an adversary to Russia. It cannot be a staging ground for NATO missiles, potentially nuclear weapons. It cannot be that. It also needs to demilitarize because of the civil war that's right upon our borders, and it is getting worse and worse and worse, right? As more weapons pour in. Seems that that happened, but Joe Biden completely ignored it and used the most crass Cold War propaganda, new Cold War propaganda, to frame the situation as Russia rejected diplomacy. This is absolutely incredible, given that the United States has never engaged in diplomacy in its history. Real diplomacy, not talking about being forced to because, let's say, the Vietnamese are kicking your ass, right? Not because of that. Not because the United States now has to sit at the table with the Taliban, because the Taliban are taking large sections of the country and defeating U.S. occupation forces. No, I'm talking about real proactive diplomacy. The United States does not engage in that. The United States is, oh, if the United States is waging war simultaneously with diplomacy, then it's not diplomacy. And that has been the case throughout the United States' history. So to hear Joe Biden blame Russia and say that Russia is the one that's not negotiating diplomacy when Russia has actually been a pretty big force in diplomatic efforts worldwide in many different conflicts using the UN Security Council in very principled ways. Whatever you think about internal Russian politics, the Russian government, Vladimir Putin, one cannot deny that Russia is a leading power in the development of a multipolar world. Can't deny that. Russia and China, that partnership is the vanguard of the multipolar world. It is, because they're huge countries, hugely influential economically, politically, and militarily. And it should come as no surprise why countries like Venezuela, Cuba, countries in Latin America, countries in Asia, why they support Russia. They're not coming out against Russia. They're not condemning Russia, and they're not cutting off ties with Russia. Actually, many of these countries, from Syria to Venezuela, supported Russia's decision to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. That's the reality. That's the way that the world is being divided based upon different visions for how international affairs, global politics, and the management of conflicts and contradictions worldwide. That's how the world is being divided in this multipolar way, where you do see multiple poles from blocks of countries that want to see diplomacy, international law respected, to the United States, which believes itself to be international law, to even Europe, which is very conflicted, mostly a junior partner to the United States. But also you can see the huge conflicts of interest that are occurring as Russia becomes more and more isolated economically. There is going to be a breaking point, and it'll be very interesting to see where that happens. But nonetheless, now that you're here, continue to like the stream, continue to subscribe if you haven't yet, and we'll keep going. So Joe Biden was bragging about isolating Russia and supporting NATO allies. And the funny thing is that, and this is a position that Bernie Sanders takes, and I think it's just completely and utterly criminal and hypocritical. And this should give one pause for anybody who still stands for Bernie Sanders. And look, I'm not trying to be demagogic and say you should hate Bernie Sanders for the sake of hating Bernie Sanders and dismissing whatever correct things he may say on domestic, his domestic agenda. We should also talk about how he has not been a leader that can sustain a movement which can actually bring about that agenda. He's not really about that. He is still about politics and his political career. But nonetheless, if we just look at how he reacts to foreign policy moments like this, to international moments of crisis, then we should be really pausing if we still stand for someone like Bernie Sanders, because Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden share the exact same view. And this view was articulated in the State of the Union address when Joe Biden was bragging about inflicting pain on Russia and isolating Russia and enforcing powerful economic sanctions and taking the oligarchic wealth of Russia. And I find this to be so utterly hypocritical and just the nastiest Russophobia, because it plays upon people's very amateurish and immature understanding of Russia. Think about this. Think about the United States telling the world, telling masses of people, telling its own public that it is waging a crusade for the Russian people to take through sanctions the economic wealth accumulated by Russian oligarchs. Think about that. Just think about what that means. It means the United States is now almost framing its warmongering and strangulation of Russia economically as a class war. It is saying that it is on the right side of a class war, that it is democratizing wealth, and that it is usurping wealth stolen from the Russian people. This is what Bernie Sanders says. I find this to be absolutely criminal, given the fact that the United States is the most heinous and most exploitative capitalist system on the planet. There is no place in the world that both has such an extreme level of inequality and levels of class exploitation and the military and economic supremacy to enforce a global order of inequality and exploitation. Russia is not in that position. And surely, if anybody knows about what has happened since 2001 in Russia, you understand that actually conditions have improved to a degree in Russia under Vladimir Putin. It's not a worker state or a worker's paradise. And surely we can see that the effects of sanctions, as well as the impact of Russia's continued allegiance to capitalism as a system, has had negative effects on the conditions of poor people. But there is no comparison between today's Russia and the Russia of post-Soviet 1991 into 2000. There's no comparison, because it was shock therapy that completely leveled and privatized the entire Russian economy and created such a level of crisis that it was Vladimir Putin who came in through the United Russia Party to stabilize the situation. And that's what has happened. The exact opposite has happened in the United States, right? There has been not even a slight improvement in living conditions. Things have gotten worse. And we'll talk about that in the second half of this analysis. But nonetheless, you have Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden in lockstep agreement that we should be bragging about starving Russia and taking the oligarchic wealth of Russia and Putin, supposedly. And Bernie Sanders erroneously claims that Putin is richer than Bill Gates and Elon Musk, or Jeff Bezos, pardon me. That's an erroneous claim with absolutely zero evidence, right? We don't see Vladimir Putin on the Forbes' list of the richest individuals or Oxford's list of the wealthiest individuals. We don't see it because there is no reliable data on that. And given the size of Russia's economy, I doubt it. I highly doubt it. So this is just how far Joe Biden and even someone like Bernie Sanders will go to demonize Russia and to act like the United States has some kind of claim, moral claim, to wage a crusade that is somehow going to benefit the Russian people. Sanctions inherently hit people. They inherently hurt people. They kill people in the thousands upon thousands around the world in places like Venezuela. We already see that Google's ban of its services in Russia is already affecting Russia's transportation system, right? And there's an interesting analysis that I engaged in and others like Carl Zah that this would never happen in China because the Great Firewall allowed for independent institutions and companies to emerge that are unfettered and untouched by U.S. finance and the ability of corporations to just pull out whenever they want. So like WeChat and Alipay, you'll never have this problem in China. Chinese people, there would be no sanctions available to the United States, NATO, Western powers that could impact Chinese society in this way. And that is part of the contradiction between capitalism and socialism. But nonetheless, bragging about Russia's pain, saying that you're going to take oligarchic wealth just recently, right, in the new year, what did Joe Biden do? He froze the assets of Afghanistan, stole them, and said, and this happened with Venezuela too, through gold. I think it was UK that did that, but with the US's blessing, of course. But in Afghanistan, right, I think it was somewhere, what, $7 billion, something like that, stolen from the people of Afghanistan and then said, oh yeah, we'll give it back in humanitarian aid and we'll give it back and we'll, you know, take the rest and, you know, support internal politics, NGOs, whatever, right? It's like the United States literally loots the wealth of countries like Afghanistan, starves them into the most extreme forms of poverty, and then has the gall to say, has the audacity to say that it is on some kind of crusade to take Russia's oligarchic wealth back and redistribute it to the people. I found that to be one of the most egregious claims of the State of the Union that just harkens on how far these sociopathic neocons will go to justify its interventions, its military interventions, and its imperialist aggression. So the funny thing about this, I laughed at this, right? All this bluster about we're supporting NATO, we're supporting Ukraine, we're supporting Ukraine. And then Joe Biden says, U.S. forces will not be going to fight in Ukraine. All he could say was, we will defend NATO allies. We will defend NATO allies. We will not defend Ukraine. So the United States, Joe Biden, in this speech said he will protect NATO countries. And Ukraine's not in NATO, right? So this is hilarious. Ukraine isn't valuable enough. It isn't valuable enough to wage a ground war or a no-fly zone or anything like that to protect it, quote unquote, from Russia. No. And this is what's hilarious is that you have a puppet like Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, begging for NATO membership and EU membership. And oh, please help us, my overlords. And they're literally telling him to his face that they don't care if they, you know, in their minds, all the propaganda, they're saying that Russia is on a mad slaughter of the Ukrainian people, but nah, we're not going to help you directly. We'll throw some weapons at you and we're going to protect our Latvian friends, our Estonian friends, our Lithuanian friends, and be, you know, you'll be okay. And Joe Biden said this to Americans, to the public. He said many times, I got your back. We're going to be okay. Right. So this is how cynical this all is. This is how absolutely laughable this can be. And laughable in the sense that sometimes you got to laugh to keep from smashing something because the criminality is just so evident. And Joe Biden's administration will go down, no doubt. We're only, what, less than 2 years in? A little over a year in. His administration will go down as one of the most criminal administrations, given that he has not only inherited all of the baggage from past administrations, but he is actually piling on the baggage and telling people in the most, and I'm not going to use the word demented because I'm a social worker. I used to work with older people, so I don't use that word, but he's doing it in the most cognitively distorted ways, right? And I don't know if y'all caught it, everyone, but he had some gaffes in there that I would show you, but you know, I don't really care that much. But he said during it, and there's a funny thing going around social media of Kamala Harris in the background, but he confused Ukrainian with Iranian. So we said, oh, we're going to protect the Iranian people or give them all of our, the Iranian people our support. but really he meant Ukrainian. And you see Kamala Harris in the background. Some people have been zooming in and you see her correcting him in the background through her lips. It's just one of those moments that just shows that not only is the U.S. ruling class at a stage where it's at its most desperate and most oppressive, therefore, but it is also at one of its most incompetent moments, where you have Joe Biden, who they did a lot probably to get him to give this speech in as articulate as he gave it. But even with all of the assistance, medically probably, he was still unable to avoid pretty big gaffes, if we're going to call them that, like confusing Ukrainian with Iranian. So nonetheless, Ukraine isn't valuable enough for U.S. protection, at least direct protection that would prevent the so-called Russian horde, quote unquote, from attacking it. So he framed all of this in this battle between autocracy and democracy, and that this iron will of the Ukrainian people will prevail against Russia, and we're all in, but actually we're not in that much because we're just going to throw weapons to our NATO allies and they can do the work. They can protect themselves. They can figure out that refugee issue. And I'll send Samantha Power over there to eat lunch and provide food to all of those refugees that we're not going to really help. And we're only going to admit the white ones, but we'll throw some, I don't know, some days old chicken or something at them and everything will be okay. I mean, that is how disrespectful the United States is to even its so-called allies, right? The United States is the hegemon, and Joe Biden showed how arrogant this hegemon can be. That has no interest in diplomacy. All it cares about is this larger vision for containing Russia and also China. And Ukraine be damned. Ukraine is just a vassal state. Whatever happens to Ukraine, it only cares about, the United States only cares about that Ukraine will remain in the U.S. NATO camp